Chapter 15. Kate sat on the couch with a martini on the table beside her. She was in her parents' living room. She was wearing a patterned shirt dress with princess seams and the pearls her mother had given her on her wedding day. She was freshly showered. Her hair was washed and draped around her shoulders. The lights were turned down low. Her feet were in a bowl of warm Epsom salts. She held an ice pack to her forehead. A heating pad was shoved down the back of her underwear. The cord hung like a tail between her legs. 6 aspirin and a Valium were working their way through her system. Every time Kate got an inkling that she might live, she remembered what her life was like and wondered if it was worth the effort. She would not go back tomorrow. She simply couldn't. So why had she brought all of her uniforms for Mary Jane to Taylor? Why had Kate hunted and pecked around on her father's typewriter for 2 hours writing up her daily report? The fact that she had begged her mother's maid to clean and mend her clothes served as a shining example of why Kate should not be doing this job. She was not Sabrina, living with her father over a wealthy man's garage. She had grown up in the main house with the Larrabees. Kate's father was a respected psychiatrist. Her mother owned a renowned art gallery. Her grandmother had been a professor of chemistry back in Holland. Kate was just as sheltered as Patrick had been. She had only ever met people like herself. She went to their restaurants. She went to their social clubs. Did the police force even have a club? Kate didn't know, and she frankly did not care. She didn't belong with those people, with their coarse language and constant criticisms. Thinking of them as those people was proof enough. But with whom did she belong? Most of her friends were all married and raising children now. Their lives were interesting, but only to other married women with children. The 2 single girls Kate had kept in touch with from college were both living in New York, much to the scandal of their mothers. Philip Van Zandt had gone to Columbia. Kate wondered if her friends had met up with him while he was in medical school. Surely there would have been a letter. It was the sort of thing you did when someone from your crowd was in town. You threw a cocktail party. You asked them to drinks. You made them feel welcome. And with a man as handsome as Dr. Van Zandt, you did a lot of other things that would further scandalize your mother. Kate let her head drop back on the couch. She moved the ice bag to her eyes. She let her memory conjure Philip's charming grin and strong, broad shoulders. He seemed so damn sure of himself. Kate could not remember the last time a man had looked at her the way Philip had. Hell, she couldn't even recall the last time a man had made love to her. The night before Patrick had shipped out was one she tried to block from her mind. She had driven down from Atlanta and met him at a seedy hotel outside the Army base. Kate had still been so desperate and angry. Patrick was drunk. The entire ordeal was sloppy and mean, and neither could look at the other afterward. Since his death, Kate had gone on a grand total of 2 dates. One ended in a handshake, the other in a chaste kiss. And then word got around to all the bachelors who knew Kate's girlfriends that she wasn't worth the dinner and drinks, and no one asked her out again. She bet Philip Van Zandt would not let her leave on a handshake. Just the thought of him made Kate's legs tremor.
Darling?
The overhead lights came on.
Oma?
Kate blinked to clear her vision. She felt a tinge of guilt, as if her grandmother could read her lustful thoughts. Not that Oma would disapprove. She was Dutch. There wasn't much that disturbed her.
Is something wrong? I thought you were out with Mom and Dad.
By great coincidence, we all developed headaches at the exact same moment.
Oma walked gracefully into the room. Her graying blonde hair was pulled into a loose chignon.
Her light makeup brought out the blue in her eyes. She was wearing a dress Kate might find in her own closet, though somehow the style looked better on her 65-year-old grandmother than it did on Kate. Oma sat in the chair beside the couch. "Will I hear stories about your first day?" "I'm not sure you'd believe them." "Try me." Kate dropped the ice bag from her forehead. Oma didn't comment on the dark bruise. Instead, she drank the rest of Kate's martini. "Caitlin, is that you?" Kate suppressed a cringe at her mother's voice. She had wanted so badly to be gone when they returned from supper.
Lisbeth frowned.
"Put your knees together, dear. Anyone could see straight up your dress." Kate forced herself not to obey. Oma offered,
"I think a young woman should open her legs as often as possible." Lisbeth ignored the observation.
She sat on the couch beside Kate. Like Oma, she was dressed for a night out. Her skirt was light blue. The matching sheer blouse had flowing sleeves that ballooned from her delicate wrists. Kate always felt reduced next to her mother. She imagined Oma gave Lisbeth the same feeling. They were like Russian nesting dolls, only rather than fat babushkas, they were diminishing blonde replicas carrying on the Dutch maternal line. Lisbeth primly crossed her legs, setting a good example. She took a cigarette from the box on the coffee table.
"Why are the lights on in the basement?"
"Mary Jane is tailoring my uniforms for me."
"She has the evening off."
"I've offered to pay her."
"That makes it all right, then."
Lisbeth's Dutch accent was always more pronounced when she was being sarcastic.
"I can't imagine a 73-year-old woman would want to be in bed at a reasonable hour."
"You're right. I'm sorry." Kate shook her head when her mother offered her a cigarette. She'd smoked her throat raw after Patrick died. Just the thought of the taste made her queasy.
"I'll apologize to her."
"And pay her as well."
Lisbeth lit her cigarette.
She studied Kate through the veil of smoke.
"You've been crying."
She had not asked a question, so Kate did not offer an answer.
"This bruise on your head, the blisters on your feet, I hesitate to guess what the heating pad is for."
Kate didn't know where to begin. The projects, the prostitute, Deep Throat. A movie she had a sinking suspicion her far more cosmopolitan grandmother had seen. She thought about the way Jimmy had pushed her around this morning, and how Maggie had said the uniform could get you anything for free, but then refused to take advantage of it herself. Then there was Gail Patterson. Never mind the beaten-down prostitute. Kate knew how to run. The only reason her arms were straight was because she was trying to keep herself from being flayed by the equipment around her waist. She asked her grandmother,
"Have you ever seen a sheep run?"
Oma laughed at the idea.
"Have I ever seen a sheep run?"
Her accent was heavier too, though this was likely the result of too many martinis.
"I once knew a Flemish girl who kept sheep."
Kate smiled. Oma's jokes often began with a Flemish girl. She had an Amsterdammer's arrogance about the Dutch-speaking region of Belgium.
"Shush with your Flemish girls."
Lisbeth put her cigarette in the ashtray. She walked over to the bar.
"We saw the afternoon journal. Had you met the police officer who was murdered?"
"No."
"I'm relieved to hear that."
Lisbeth used the tongs to put ice in the martini shaker.
"I hope they get the right person this time. The paper mentioned Edward Spivey. His life was ruined by that trial. He had to move to the other side of the country."
"Justice always prevails."
Oma turned to Kate.
"Isn't that right, dear?"
Kate nodded, though she wasn't sure how she felt. She had gathered that no one in uniform thought Edward Spivey was innocent, whereas most of the people Kate knew assumed that the police had tried to frame him for the crime.
Where's Daddy?
In his greenhouse.
Lisbeth poured a generous splash of vodka into the shaker.
He's worried about his orchids. There's something wrong with the heater. Kate hadn't technically lied to Maggie Lawson. Her father was passionate about gardening. Oma asked,
How are the people at work? Did you make any new friends?
Kate would have laughed if she'd had the energy.
They're fantastic. It's like Seneca Falls without the organization or camaraderie.
Oma frowned.
I'm sorry, dear.
Were they mean?
Kate felt like she was back in junior high again, crying to her grandmother about the cruel girls on the bus. Though Maggie and Gail and the rest of them weren't exactly cruel. At least, not to Kate.
She said, They're all just really tough. They walk around in armor.
Lisbeth noted.
I imagine they have to.
No, that's not what she means.
Oma crossed her hands in her lap.
Sometimes women with a little bit of power can be much harder than men, especially on other women. They have to distance themselves from the weakness of their sex, yes?
Kate looked at her mother. She generally disagreed with whatever Oma said.
For once, Lisbeth didn't offer her opinion.
She held the shaker between both hands as she mixed the martinis. Ice clanked against the stainless steel. Her sleeve had fallen down. Kate saw the tattoo on the outer side of her left forearm. The letter A followed by five numbers. Oma asked,
Are you attempting to punish the ice?
Lisbeth stilled the shaker.
She put two glasses on the coffee table and filled each one.
Caitlin, did you eat all of the olives?
Of course she did. She loves olives.
Oma offered Kate's empty glass to fill.
I told Margot Kleinman that my granddaughter was a police officer.
You would think I had told her you were an astronaut.
She raised her glass to Kate.
It's wonderful you found a way to help people, darling.
Reluctantly, Kate picked up her glass. She met her grandmother's gaze, then her mother's, then downed half the drink.
That's lovely,
Oma said, meaning the martini. She told Kate,
It's very important for your life to have meaning. Even on the days it makes you unhappy, you still need a purpose.
Lisbeth sat on the couch.
She stroked Kate's hair behind her ear, then rested her hand on Kate's shoulder.
It's nice that you're wearing your pearls.
Kate stared at the cigarette smoldering in the ashtray. She was probably six or seven the first time she'd noticed her mother's tattoo. She was in the bathtub getting her ears scrubbed.
What's that?
Kate had asked.
Nothing, Schreitke. Hold still.
Darling, Oma asked,
are you tired? Should we leave you alone?
No,
Kate rubbed her mother's hand. Please don't.
Will you tell us about your day?
Oma waited expectantly.
Was it terrible?
Kate smiled at her grandmother. Oma's dress was long-sleeved, covering the tattoo that was on the inside of her left arm. Same letter, different numbers.
As with Lisbeth,
she'd been sent to Auschwitz. But when the Nazis had discovered that Oma was a professor, they'd sent her to Mauthausen, a so-called bone grinder camp, designed to work intellectuals to death.
Lisbeth said,
You're very distracted. Did something bad happen today?
Kate held on to her mother's hand.
Nothing happened.
She lied. And then she figured that since she was lying, she should put her heart into it.
Work wasn't that bad. My feet don't hurt any more than when I've danced all night. And this,
she indicated her forehead,
is because I've apparently forgotten how to look where I'm going when I wear a hat.
Oma leaned back, smiling.
I suppose the worst part is having to get out of bed before 10. I can't imagine.
Moo there,
you're always up before I am.
Lisbeth seemed more relieved than Oma. She took one last smoke before extinguishing her cigarette.
I know, because half the coffee is always gone.
It's very good coffee. How can I stop myself?
Kate wasn't sure if it was the volume or the heating pad, but she finally felt her muscles begin to unknot. The room had taken on a lightness that hadn't been there before. She tried to think of something else to tell.
I think the most galling part is that I never realized how smart I am about things that have absolutely no consequence in the real world.
Neither her mother nor her grandmother objected to the observation.
I'm not used to feeling so stupid.
That, Kate understood, was the rock she had been forced to push uphill all day. People had talked to her like she was an idiot, because in many ways, she was an idiot.
I don't know how to talk to strangers. I don't know how to stand up for myself. Apparently, I don't know how to run. I even had to be told how to go to the bathroom.
Both looked confused. Kate couldn't find a way to make it sound funny, so she chose not to explain.
There are just all sorts of practical things that I've never had to deal with. I've never felt so out of place.
Kate drank her martini, so she didn't see the look exchanged between her mother and grandmother.
The least you could do is pretend to be surprised by this revelation.
The look was exchanged again.
Of course you'll learn, Oma soothed. This job, it's good to help people, yes, to give back.
Kate nodded, though she couldn't think of one damn thing she'd done all day that contributed to the well-being of anyone, least of all, herself.
You're right. Of course you're right.
Oma said,
I remember that nice police captain who spoke to us when the temple was bombed. She put down her drink. We were all very worried, of course. We'd never met the police officer here except to ask directions. He was very serious. One of our crowd, surprisingly. When was that, 56?
58?
Kate had been 8 years old when the temple on Peachtree was nearly destroyed. They lived close enough that they heard the dynamite explode.
Those fools thought we'd be there on a Sunday,
Lisbeth said.
But maybe they weren't so stupid.
They got away with it.
Oma was never one to dwell on the negative.
The point I am making is that the police were very helpful. They made us feel safe again.
She smiled so sweetly that Kate felt her heart breaking in two.
And now, you are making people feel safe, Caitlin. What a gift you're giving to the world.
Kate knew there was a prostitute on Cheshire Bridge Road who would certainly disagree. But she smiled for her grandmother's sake.
Lisbeth asked,
It makes things easier for you, yes.
She meant after Patrick. Kate supposed what she had done today was better than staying in bed all day and crying over something that would never change. Sitting right in front of her were two sterling examples of women with the strength to carry on past unspeakable tragedies. And the tragedies did go unspoken. Neither her mother nor grandmother ever talked about what happened to them during the war. They refused to dwell on their losses. Kate knew facts, but not details. Oma had lost her mother and father, a brother, her husband, and a son. Lisbeth had lost the same. She was barely a teenager when she was transported to the camps. Each had assumed the other was dead until the Red Cross managed to reunite them after the liberation. And here they sat, trying to comfort Kate as if her aching body and bruised ego were of any consequence. Kate told her mother,
Yes, you are right. It's good to have something to do.
Something useful.
Oma raised her glass in another toast.
I'm very proud of you, darling. This is unconventional, what you're doing, of course, but always know that your family is very proud of you. You've made us very happy.
You have,
Lisbeth agreed,
though we would have been equally as proud had you kept that last job as a secretary.
Who comb ye erby?
Oma muttered. She was an awful secretary.
She wasn't that bad.
Je ish te schlimm for that sort work. Mother.
The two women switched to their native tongue. Kate tuned them out. She understood only half of what they were saying. As with most Americans, Dutch sounded to her more like a disease of the throat than an actual language. Kate leaned forward so that she could dry her feet. Her back twinged with the movement. Her vision swam. Suddenly, she was so tired that she could barely stay upright. The clock over the fireplace showed it was almost 11 o'clock. The thought of driving home was too much. Kate could stay and sleep in her old room. Mary Jane would have her uniforms ready. She could use her mother's makeup, or if she was lucky, Maggie would open her locker and Kate could retrieve her purse. Her purse. It was only through divine intervention that Kate had been able to drive her car tonight. Years ago, Patrick had stuck a magnetic key box under the wheel well, or she'd still be sitting in the parking lot off Central Avenue. Kate would have to get a combination lock. She would pay for it because it didn't seem right not to. They probably had some locks at the pro shop inside the tennis club. She could borrow one from her father until she had time to go. With a start, Kate realized that she was really returning to work tomorrow. She wasn't going to quit after her first day. How had that happened? Certainly through no conscious effort of her own. Her grandmother wasn't a quitter. Her mother had never given up. Their blood flowed in Kate's veins. Compared to what they had survived, the Atlanta Police Department was a walk in the park. She could do this. She had to do this. As if on cue, Mary Jane came into the room with Kate's uniforms neatly folded in her arms.
I got the stain out of one, but you can probably see where I had to stitch the tear in the sleeve.
Kate began.
I'm so sorry that I...
Her voice trailed off. Philip Van Zandt was standing behind Mary Jane. He was wearing a charcoal gray Hickey Freeman suit with a light purple shirt. The hair on his chest showed beneath his unbuttoned collar. His pants were closely tailored to his body. The legs gently flared out below his knees. He said,
"Good evening again, Mrs. Herschel, Mrs. DeVries."
He was showing off. He pronounced Oma's name like he were riding a bike along the Heerenfracht.
"I'm afraid I gave Mary Jane a fright, knocking on the basement door."
Kate knew exactly why he was knocking on that particular door. All her friends knew she had moved downstairs when she turned 14 because her parents could no longer endure Kate's giggly slumber parties. Besides that, her car was in the driveway and almost every light was on in the house.
"All right."
Mary Jane had never been one for tension. She put the uniforms on the sideboard.
"I'll be off now."
Kate said,
"I'm so sorry I kept you up this late."
Mary Jane waved away her concern, but Kate felt awful as she watched the old woman shuffle toward the back stairs. Philip gave the maid a slight bow as she passed him.
"Ladies, my apologies for coming so late unannounced, but my mother was at the club tonight and it seems she may have picked up your lipstick by mistake."
He held a tube of lipstick in his hand. The item was the sort of thing you'd find in a corner store. All the women knew this. Philip knew this. Yet he pretended he was performing a remarkable act of chivalry.
Oma was always game for deception.
"Yes, that belongs to me. Thank you, Philip. You're so thoughtful to return it."
Lisbeth wasn't so easy.
I forgot to ask your mother how your wife is doing. I believe she's studying in Israel.
She turned to Kate. Philip is married now.
Yes, I know,
Kate said, just like she knew if she tried to stand up, the heating pad would pull her back to the couch like a slingshot.
Israel,
Oma echoed wistfully. Philip, have you seen Dr. Herschel's stamps from the Hapoel games? His smile said the mere thought delighted him.
I haven't had the pleasure.
If you could?
Oma held out her hand. Philip helped her stand. While his back was turned, Kate yanked the heating pad out from under her dress. The noise was awful, like a sash being pulled through a belt loop. Philip turned toward her. He looked at the heating pad on the couch. He looked at Kate. Kate looked at the floor. Oma said,
I'll find the stamps. Lisbeth, get some fresh ice from the kitchen.
Unusually, Kate took her mother's view.
It's very late, Oma. I think Philip must have work in the morning.
He held open his arms.
I have the whole day off.
Really? She asked, because what was he doing here? It was one thing to share a harmless flirtation, but this was taking it a step too far.
Maybe you should spend the time writing a letter to your wife.
I've already written two. I told her all about seeing you today.
You saw each other?
Lisbeth's voice went up suspiciously.
When was this?
At the hospital, Kate answered. Then, because she didn't want to tell her mother that another police officer had been shot, she lied.
Philip was giving me information about a case.
Philip winked at Kate.
Your daughter is quite the detective.
She tends to figure things out quickly.
Lisbeth held a fresh cigarette between her fingers. Philip leaned down with a light.
I'll have a gin and tonic, Caitlin. Extra ice.
Liefert?
Oma called from the hallway.
Can you help me in the study, please?
Lisbeth stabbed her cigarette into the ashtray.
Your father will check on you before he comes to bed.
Thank you, Kate said, though they both knew that her father was likely asleep by now.
Philip won't be staying long.
I'm sure. Good evening, Mrs. Herschel.
Philip bowed as she left, the same as he had with Mary Jane. He told Kate,
such a lovely woman.
Kate warned,
you shouldn't vex her.
The tactic seems to be working well for me with her daughter.
It's really not.
Kate grabbed the ice bucket as she headed toward the kitchen. She pushed through the swinging door. She leaned against the counter. Her hands were shaky, but not because of Philip. She was exhausted. It was late, and he was married.
I should look at that bruise.
Philip stood a few feet away. The kitchen door swung silently behind him. He certainly liked to make an entrance.
How did it happen?
For a change, she told the truth.
I ran directly into a wall.
He didn't laugh.
Did you lose consciousness?
No.
See stars?
Kate crossed her arms over her chest.
What's the point of this?
I'm a doctor. This is an exam. Did you see stars?
She relented.
Yes.
Feel dizzy?
She nodded.
Were you nauseated?
She nodded again.
Threw up?
A little.
Get up on the counter.
Philip, I...
You could be concussed.
He put his hands on her waist and lifted her up.
Your back feels like it's on fire.
The heating pad.
It's where I store my vexation.
Philip laughed. He kept his hands on her waist.
Did you take something?
Aspirin and Valium.
Are you on any other medication?
No.
Birth control?
She hated herself for blushing.
Yes, but not for...
He held up one finger in front of her face.
Follow.
She tracked his movement back and forth.
Let me check your eyes.
He pressed at the lids.
Look up.
She did as she was told.
Now down.
Again, she complied. Tell me if anything is tender. He palpated her face and neck with his fingers. Open your mouth.
She opened her mouth.
Open your legs.
Why?
So I can run my hand up the inside of your thigh.
She gasped, because she'd blindly complied, and that was exactly what he had done. Instead of clenching her knees together or slapping him away, Kate sat perfectly still.
You are a married man in my father's house with your hand up my dress.
Only halfway up.
He gently stroked the inside of her thigh with the tips of his fingers. His touch was like a butterfly fluttering against her skin. Kate started to sweat.
Philip, stop.
He stopped stroking her, but he didn't remove his hand. His palm rested against the inside of her leg. His skin was hot. He looked at her mouth.
Do you still taste like strawberries?
Kate had difficulty finding her voice.
That was lip gloss.
It was delicious.
He started stroking her thigh again.
You're so beautiful, Caitlin. Do you know that? You're perfect.
Philip.
She managed. His touch was unbearably tender. She felt a tremble working through her body.
You were the first girl I ever kissed who wasn't my cousin.
Kate pushed his shoulder.
Why do you joke about everything?
Because it's funny. I'm a married man in your father's house, and I'm standing here with my hand up your dress.
Maybe if it hadn't been Kate's father and Kate's dress, she would have seen the humor.
I asked you to stop.
Do you really want me to?
Kate didn't know what she wanted.
What about your wife?
My wife is for making babies. You're for fucking.
The sting was unexpected.
That's an awful thing to say.
Trust me, one is a lot more fun than the other.
Why would I trust you?
You shouldn't.
Philip's hand moved higher up her leg. His fingers brushed against her. Kate's breath caught. She could feel him through the thin cotton of her underwear. He knew exactly what he was doing. Everything melted away under his touch. There was nothing but the firm pressure of him moving between her legs.
That's good.
He watched her face as he stroked up and down.
You can feel that?
Kate nodded.
God, could she feel it? It's good.
She gripped his shoulders. The muscles moved beneath her hands. She wanted to kiss him. He wouldn't let her. She tried to pull him closer. He wouldn't come. He just kept staring at her, gauging her reaction as he touched her.
Hey, your vexation is even hotter down here.
Shut up,
Kate breathed. She was quivering. The feel of him was almost too much. Philip kissed her neck. Kate wanted to be devoured by his mouth. His lips were so soft. His face was so rough. She reached for his belt, but he stopped her. She tried to pull down her underwear. He stopped her.
Philip.
Shh.
The sound of his deep voice pulsed through her body. She was so close.
Will you do me a favor, Caitlin?
She nodded because she was breathing too hard to answer.
Knock on my door.
He whispered.
Will you knock on my door?
She shook her head. He was making her crazy.
Like the song, knock 3 times, okay?
For what?
For me to fuck you.
His hand moved ever so slightly forward. Kate's nerves ignited. She was on the edge. His mouth was still at her ear, his tongue, his teeth. Every sensation reverberated between her legs. She didn't know what he was doing anymore. She was too consumed by want.
He said, "Only when you're ready. But soon, okay?"
Kate couldn't answer. She was almost there. Her body throbbed with anticipation. He backed off the pressure.
"Okay."
"Yes,"
she whispered, begged.
"Yes."
Slowly, Philip took away his hand. His wet fingers dragged across her skin. He tenderly kissed her forehead. Kate opened her eyes.
"What are you?"
His thumb traced along her lips. She could smell herself on him.
"Soon, okay?"
He knocked 3 times on the counter, then turned and walked away. Chapter 16. Fox sat in front of his television. He was drunk and he was pissed off. Too pissed even to watch Kate, which meant that he was only punishing himself. He deserved the punishment. He had failed. It was the sort of thing that would have happened to Fox Sr., sitting in a bar with a bunch of faggots while some woman was doing his job. Or at least trying to do his job. Sheer luck was the only thing that had kept Jimmy Lawson above ground. Fox had heard it on the police scanner. The old woman had used a .44 Magnum. Jimmy's arm had taken the bullet when it should have been his head. Fox was not going to shift blame. This wasn't like the first time, when Fox had turned the corner onto the alley and found Don Wesley on his knees going at it with Jimmy Lawson. Any man would have frozen in that kind of situation. And the gun had jammed. And Lawson had jumped behind a dumpster, and Fox had left because a good soldier knew when to retreat. Today was not the same. Fox had been squarely in the wrong. Jimmy wasn't on his way to the bar, looking for some queer to lick his wounds. He was looking for the man who had put down his faggot partner. That was all it took. The plan no longer sat in the back of Fox's mind, working through the options, spitballing images of Kate Murphy to keep him on the hook. The plan was going to happen. Part 1. Jimmy couldn't just be killed anymore. He had to be used. Because Fox had to prove to himself that he was back in control. Part 2. The pawn would be sacrificed for the queen. Fox put down his drink. That was the important part. He needed to be clear-headed for this. He could no longer sit idly by, waiting for lightning to jolt the thing from the back of his skull into the front. Fox knew all the options. He had to figure out the best way to combine Part 1 and Part 2 into an executable plan. The sooner, the better. One thing Fox had learned during the war was that once a man knew he was marked, he started acting smarter. He noticed his surroundings. He took precautions. He varied his routine. Fox liked routine. He needed routine. Routine had always served him well, no matter what target he was hunting. He picked up his clipboard and paged back through his log. Friday of last week, Wednesday of last week, Monday of last week. He went back farther, another Friday, another Wednesday, another Monday. The same pattern the week before. Kate's visits to her parents were like clockwork. Fox guessed that made her a good girl, inasmuch as a filthy Jewess could ever be thought of as good. She always dressed up for her visits. She never wore pants. Most nights, she stayed over at their house, which made things more complicated but also gave Fox more options. Anybody who knew Fox knew he liked options almost as much as he liked routine. Option 1. The thicket of shrubs near the basement window to Kate's bedroom. The bed was a single, probably from her childhood. There were posters on the wall, The Beatles, which he could forgive her for, Paul Newman, which he could not. Soft pink sheets. Matching walls. A dark purple blanket she draped over the bed when it was cold. The bathroom door was always left ajar. A nightlight made it possible for Fox to track the rise and fall of her chest. He timed her breath using the second hand on his watch. If he was lucky, she got up in the night, and he would see through the sliver of light Kate's nightgown. White cotton. Almost transparent. When there was a full moon, Fox could see the darkness of her secret places through the thin material. Option two, the mudroom by the kitchen. They usually left the light on, which meant Fox could stand at the door and see inside the kitchen. Kate always carried the dinner plates to the sink. Sometimes she would stand there watching the water run. Other times, she would sit at the kitchen table and talk to her grandmother. Grandmother. At first, Fox had thought she was the mother and that the mother was an older sister. He'd finally had to knock on the door and pretend he was taking a survey for the phone company in order to ascertain the relationship. The mother had invited him in. The grandmother had joined the conversation shortly after. They had served him coffee and cookies, and Fox had asked to use the restroom because just being that close to women who looked like Kate made him hard as a rock. Option three, the fallen tree in the front yard. Fox had sat behind it just that night and watched Kate walk up the curving sidewalk to the front door. She moved like a cat. Languid was the word. Sexy as hell. She was wearing high-heeled shoes that flexed her calves in such a way that a lesser man would have put his hands down his pants to relieve the pressure. Fox had to walk away because he had fucked up too many things today to think that he could remain in control. Punishment number one, he didn't get to watch her change for bed. Punishment number two, he didn't get to watch her wrap the purple blanket around her shoulders and lie down. Punishment number three, he didn't get to relieve the pressure in his pants as he watched the rhythmic movement of her chest. 1638, talk to doctor in hospital ER, parenthesis, capital P, end parenthesis. 1718, cried in car parked outside police station, parenthesis, capital P, end parenthesis. 1901, closed curtains at hotel, parenthesis, capital P, end parenthesis. Pressure. This wasn't the first time a Jew had caused him trouble. When Fox was 9 years old, a Hebrew family bought the house three doors down. The Feldmans moved in one weekend, then by the next, everybody had a for sale sign in their front yard. Two houses sold. Then word got out, and nobody could sell anything for a reasonable price. Senior told Fox he had seen this kind of thing before. One Jew moves in, then the property values plummet, then the rest of the Jews swoop down like vultures. Lesson six, never trust a Jew. As with many of Senior's predictions, this one hadn't come to fruition. No one could afford to walk away from their mortgages. The Jews hadn't swept in. There was just the Feldmans and the animosity that bubbled up and down the street. Still, Fox always thought of Hebrews as vultures. Not theoretically, but in a literal sense. They were all dark, with black hair and dark eyes and beaked noses. Feldman's wife was plump and shifty-looking, and all the kids scattered when she went to the mailbox because everybody knew a Jew could curse you. The eldest daughter was a different story. Rebecca Feldman was dark, too, but she wasn't plump. She was curvy. Her lips were a perfect red bow. She wore shapely skirts that showed her hips and sweaters. Not a man on that street didn't look forward to autumn when Rebecca Feldman wore her tight sweaters. She did it on purpose. They all knew that. She teased them. She toyed with them.
and they couldn't do a damn thing about it without bringing down the law. Lesson 7. All Jewesses are promiscuous whores. The first time Fox got hard was when he saw Rebecca Feldman in one of those sweaters. He didn't know what was happening. He ran home to his room. He hid under the covers. He sweated like a maniac because he thought the Jew had cursed him. And then his hands had worked to relieve the pressure. And all he could think about after that was what he wanted to do to her. Peel off that sweater. Slide down that skirt. Fox wasn't sure what would come next, but he knew instinctively that the Jew had to pay for what she did to him, because Fox was out of control. In those moments when he ran to his room and ducked under the sheets, the pressure was in charge. And now the same thing was happening all over again. Only this time, the Jew was Kate. Day 2, Tuesday. Chapter 17. For the second time in as many days, Kate pushed her way through the thick throng of men in the squad room. She ignored the leers. She crossed her arms over her chest to keep the groping to a minimum. Unfortunately, she couldn't cover her ears. "Bah," they bleated. "Bah." Of all the nicknames that had been trotted out yesterday, from Irish Spring to China Doll, why was this the one that was sticking? Someone tipped his hat to Kate. "Hello, Lamb Chop." Her smile turned into a grimace. "Bah." Finally, the door. Kate was careful not to open it too wide. From the frying pan into the fire. Wanda Clack was sitting on the bench loading up her utility belt. She saw Kate and let out a "bah." Kate plastered on her smile, held up her hands in surrender. She didn't know how much longer she could do this. She was dying inside. Wanda said, "Look at you with your uniform. I'd have to think twice before I called you a man." "Thank you very much." Kate smoothed down the shirt, which was still blousy. She'd asked Mary Jane to leave more room than usual. "You get that Jew to do it?" Wanda laughed. "He didn't poke you with his horns." Kate knew better than to tell the truth about herself. The last thing she needed was another mark against her. The door opened. Maggie slid in. She raised her eyebrows, seemingly surprised that Kate was here. Kate felt her leg being slapped. "Lend me a hoof, sheep." Wanda held out her hand. Kate didn't know what to do but help leverage her up. Wanda gave a loud groan as she stood. The equipment around her belt creaked. "Well, I gotta say, after what happened yesterday, none of us thought you'd show up again." Kate tried for jocularity. "Surprise." "You said it." Wanda winked at her before she edged like a crab out the door. Kate smiled at Maggie, but she was busy dialing the combination on her locker. "Good morning." Maggie yanked open the lock. "How'd you get home last night?"
"Spare key."
"Magnetic box under the wheel well?"
"How did you know?"
She tossed Kate her purse. "That's what the victim usually tells me when I'm taking a stolen car report." Kate held her purse to her chest. Could she leave? Would it be that easy? Could she just turn around and leave? Maggie asked, "You get a lock or do you need to use mine again?" At least Kate had done one thing right today. She held up the lock she'd taken from her father's suitcase. Maggie studied the lock with great disapproval. Still, she opened a locker 3 down from her own. Number 8, right beside the curtain the colored girls had put up.
"Thank you."
Kate didn't really need anything from her purse, but she opened it anyway as she walked across the room. Everything was in there, makeup, gum, a few tampons,
some change that she shouldn't let float around. She unbuckled her wallet. She checked the cash compartment, but not for her money. Her wedding photo rested among the bills. Patrick was dressed in a dark blue suit and tie. His hair was neatly combed. Kate was wearing a white knee-length dress with a peplum that fluttered loosely around her hips. She remembered her pearls kept catching on the light shearing at the sweetheart neckline. They had been married at the courthouse by a judge and not by a priest at the Cathedral of Christ the King, which was why Patrick's parents had not attended the ceremony. Kate had always assumed that she was agnostic like her parents, which fact still didn't allow them entrance into the Gentile country club. She'd gone to temple as a child because it made her Oma happy. She'd gone to bar mitzvahs for the camaraderie and cake. She enjoyed an occasional Shabbat and preferred Christmas to Hanukkah, but there was no way in hell she would dishonor what had happened to her family by getting married in a Catholic church. "Everything in there?" Maggie asked. Kate looked up. "I didn't take your money."
"I didn't think you had."
Kate closed the wallet and shoved it back into her purse. "You're with me again today." Maggie rested her hand on her revolver. "Is that a problem?"
"I'm delighted."
Her eyes narrowed. "If you want lunch, take some cash with you. Lipstick is okay, but nothing dark. You got your notebook and pen?" Kate tapped her breast pocket. "Did you turn in your reports?"
"First thing."
"Get your citation book. We're skipping roll call today." She slammed her locker closed. "Meet me on the back stairs in 5 minutes." Kate gathered she was not supposed to ask for details.
"Yes, ma'am."
Maggie slipped out the door. No one else came in. Kate had never been alone in the locker room before. She glanced at the area behind the curtain, wondering just what was back there. More lockers, she saw. There was a stack of Negro magazines at the end of their bench. A small table with a glass vase was tucked into the corner. There was only a single flower, a daisy, but it looked fresh. Something bumped against the door, and Kate nearly jumped out of her skin. She didn't know which would be worse, being here when the colored girls came, or being late, meeting Maggie on the stairs. She took some cash from her wallet and pocketed her lipstick, which was absolutely too dark. But what was Maggie going to do? Arrest her? Kate put the lipstick back in her purse. She quickly figured out why Maggie had disapproved of the suitcase lock. The shackle barely fit through the slot in the locker door. She had to force it closed. The tiny key could easily slip out of her pocket. Kate felt certain she'd feel it. Her hips were black and blue from the Kel light and nightstick beating into her yesterday afternoon. She was shocked she'd managed to get to sleep last night. Of course, she had been shocked by a lot of things last night. None more so than the mind-blowing 30 seconds it had taken for her to finish what Philip Van Zandt had started. She'd never had a man touch her down there before. Patrick thought it was kinky that time they did it standing up in the foyer.
"Dear Patrick,"
she silently composed in her head,
"thank you for your last letter. I have been very busy myself. I met a colorful pimp yesterday morning. I watched a whore get tortured. I helped resolve a dispute over a sandwich. I let a near stranger finger me in my mother's kitchen. Hope you are not the same."
The door opened. Kate panicked. The colored girls were here. There were four of them. They glared at her. She put her head down and tried for a quick exit. They didn't make it easy. They crowded together so that she had to push her way through.
Sorry,
Kate apologized. They were worse than the men. Her hat was tipped. Her shoulders were bumped like she was traveling through a car wash. A foot came out to trip her. She barely managed to stumble into the outer room.
"Bah!"
a fat cop screamed in her face. Kate's good humor was spent for the morning. She had no idea where the back stairs were, but she assumed back meant to the rear of the room. There was an exit sign over a door. Kate made her way toward it. The going was easier. Most everyone was taking their seat for roll call. She wasn't sure how this would work. If Kate wasn't checked in by the duty officer, did that mean she wasn't technically working? What took so long? Maggie stood at the bottom of a set of large marble stairs. She didn't seem to expect an answer. Come on. There was nothing to do but follow her up the stairs. Kate concentrated on her feet as she climbed. Her shoes were still slipping, even though she was wearing two pairs of her father's socks. Her hat kept falling down over her eyes. She bumped it up. It slid back down. She bumped it up again. Maggie said, "You're allowed to take off your hat." Maggie's hat was still on, so Kate left hers in place.
"Is your brother all right?"
"Look up."
"What?"
Kate looked up. She was one step away from running straight into a towering black woman. There were two of them standing at the top of the stairs. They had identical uniforms and identical tightly shaved afros. Their name badges read Delroy and Watson. They stared openly at Kate. Delroy said, "She sure is white as a sheep."
"Uh-huh."
Watson nodded in agreement.
"You'd think she'd have learned after yesterday to look where she's going."
She reached out with one hand and knocked the hat off Kate's head. Maggie grabbed Kate's arm to keep her from retrieving her hat.
"Listen up, sheep." Delroy used a pointed finger to explain. "You look left, you look right, you look up, you look down."
Watson finished.
"You do the hokey pokey and you turn yourself around."
They both clapped.
"That's what it's all about."
They both laughed, but Watson kept her eyes zeroed in on Kate.
"We ain't joking here, white sheep. You gotta know everything around you all the time. That's the only way you're gonna stay alive, you feel me?"
"I feel you," Kate mumbled, sounding like the whitest Jew who had ever taken a wrong turn out of Buckhead.
"She feels me," Delroy told her partner. "You hear that?"
Watson tried to imitate Kate's accent.
"I feel you, lovey."
Delroy went for a Thurston Howell.
"Thank you, my dear. Might I feel you later after we share some cocktails at the club?"
"We don't have time for this." Maggie nodded toward a closed door. She let Delroy and Watson go ahead of them. Then she nodded for Kate to retrieve her hat. Kate did as she was told, offering a cheerful,
"You're full of nods this morning."
Maggie was already in the room, which was another storage closet. This one was actually used for storage. Metal shelves contained pens, folders, staples, notepads. Maggie nodded for Kate to shut the door. As usual, Kate did as she was told. She had to assume there was a reason Maggie had been so tight-lipped about meeting these women. The curtain in the dressing room wasn't the only thing that separated the colored girls from the whites. Delroy asked,
"We gonna do this in front of the sheep?"
"She won't talk," Maggie said, which Kate took as a compliment. "I need a favor." Delroy twisted her lips to the side.
"Go on."
"There's a pimp I need to talk to, named Sir She."
"Sir She," Delroy repeated. "Tranny pimp, works out of CT.
"You know him?"
"Heard of him," Delroy said. "We've dealt with a couple of his girls. Got the shit kicked out of them for not turning in their money."
Watson added,
"He wears these white boots, got gold tips on them. Tore this one girl up so bad she won't ever pee straight again."
"Where does he live?" Maggie asked.
"He's renting rooms in a boarding house off Huff."
Maggie nodded for the umpteenth time. "Good. That's what we got off a witness yesterday." Kate noticed that Maggie didn't volunteer how they had gotten the information from Violet. "Anything else?"
Delroy said, "Boarding house is run by a freaky Portuguese chick. Old as dirt, but I wouldn't cross her." She turned to her partner. "What's the house number, 815? 819. Watson wrinkled her nose. "Damn old Biddy looks like she's got spiders in her hair." Maggie asked, "Portuguese? What's a white woman doing living in CT? "You crackers gonna let some damn foreigner live in your backyard?" Delroy trotted out her snooty accent again.
"She used to live up near the shopping mall, but the noise was atrocious."
"Better," Kate admitted. She'd really nailed the intonations.
Maggie held out her arm and physically pushed Kate out of the conversation. "Are any of them carrying?"
"So she don't carry. The one you gotta worry about is the big-ass mother works for him. Fat as a whale, crazy as a loon. Matter of fact, both of them are tetched from what I hear. But the big one is just flat-out motherfucking crazy, know what I mean?"
Delroy gave Kate a meaningful look.
"He's got a thing about white women. Don't like 'em. And that's for real, sheep."
Watson looked at Kate, too.
"He likes 'em good enough when he's cutting 'em up. Keeps a switchblade on him. Pulls it out like magic, and next thing you know, half your face is hanging off the bone."
Kate willed herself not to shudder. Maggie asked,
"But no guns?"
Watson shrugged. "I told you we ain't never met the brothers. They're new in town, been here maybe 5-6 months.
Delroy said, "No time to bring a welcome basket, you dig?"
Watson said, "This is just shit we heard about him."
Delroy added, "It's good shit, but it's still shit."
"Okay."
Maggie crossed her arms over her chest. She waited. Watson stared at Delroy. Delroy stared at Watson.
Watson said, "Sir, she runs old whores off Whitehall."
Delroy said,
"That's where Don Wesley got shot."
"Where Lawson's brother almost got shot, too," Watson reminded her partner.
"She must be looking for a gal, saw something, maybe wants to see if she can get her to talk."
"Girl won't talk without the pimps, okay?" They both continued to stare at each other in silence. Finally, Delroy nodded. Watson nodded, too. Delroy told Maggie,
"Give us until lunchtime. We'll make sure you got passage into CT after that. Straight to Huff and back, that's all we can guarantee."
"Deal." Maggie didn't offer her thanks.
"What have you got for me?"
Watson was obviously prepared.
"Black girl got raped 2 nights ago over in Midtown. All night long. 13 years old, ended up in the Grady ER needing stitches. We think one of yours did it."
"I've got a sister that age."
Maggie bumped Kate's arm, indicating she should write this down.
"You get a description?"
Watson answered,
"Better than that.
Name's Lewis Wendell Conroy III. 21 years old. He's a student over at Georgia Tech, originally from Berwyn, Maryland, where my people tell me he's already got one sexual assault complaint off of a 14-year-old that his daddy took care of."
Kate looked up. Maggie's lips were parted. Kate had never seen her caught surprised. Maggie asked,
"He loses clothes?"
"Why you ask that?"
Maggie didn't answer. Watson pulled a thick brown wallet out of her back pocket and handed it to Maggie.
"Cocksucker must have been stoned out of his mind. His clothes were right there on the floor, but he grabbed her granddaddy's raincoat and bugged out."
Maggie flipped through to the license. She stared at the photograph.
"Shit."
Kate looked over her shoulder. The man was college-aged, with a round face and wispy blonde hair.
"I knew something wasn't right about him," Maggie told the women. "I had this asshole yesterday morning, but there was nothing I could keep him on."
"Well, now you got something."
Maggie checked the rest of the wallet.
There was a picture of an older couple, probably his parents. She stopped on a student ID from Georgia Tech. Watson said,
"The girl's daddy took the money."
Delroy added,
"Ain't gonna buy her cherry back, but it paid for the pain medication."
"That's not what I'm looking for." Maggie pocketed the student ID and the license. She tried to hand back the wallet. "There's two credit cards in there." Delroy didn't like that.
"He's not a thief."
Maggie put the wallet on one of the shelves. "We'll pick this guy up. The girl willing to testify?" The women laughed at the very idea. Maggie said,
"What do you want me to do, Del? I can't arrest him off nothing."
"Find something," Delroy ordered. Kate heard the edge in the woman's voice.
"You had to interview that girl in the hospital. Explain to her why she can't get her cooch wet until the stitches come out. You'd be over there right now dragging this baby-raping motherfucker out of calculus."
"All right," Maggie agreed. "But his daddy's obviously connected. Even if I lock him up, he'll be out in less than 24 hours. Watson looked at Delroy again. Kate wondered if they were telepathic. Delroy said,
"You get him back on our side of town, we'll take it from there."
"Okay." Maggie didn't seem concerned with what they'd do to him. "I'll talk to my guys and put the details in your locker."
"You do that," Delroy told Kate. "And you, little sheep, look where you're going next time."
The meeting was concluded. There was no small talk or asking after each other's parents. Maggie nodded for Kate to open the door. They left the storage room, but instead of going back toward the stairs, Maggie headed down the hall. Kate almost ran into her when she stopped. Maggie turned back around and called,
"Del, you know a place called Dabbler's?"
Both women sputtered with laughter. Delroy said,
"Dabbler's? Girl, you crazy."
They were still laughing as they walked down the stairs. Kate asked,
"Are we going to see Cersei?"
Maggie didn't acknowledge the joke. "Didn't you hear what they said? After lunchtime, we got at least 4 hours until we're cleared."
"Cleared for..."
Maggie walked down the hall. Kate had no choice but to follow her. She rested her hand on her revolver the same way Maggie did. She tried to keep pace, but her shoes made it hard for her to do more than shuffle along. "Put away your notebook." Maggie was back to sounding annoyed. Kate clicked the pen, closed the notebook, and returned both to her breast pocket. "Don't put anything about that guy in your report."
"Why?"
"Because we don't have a warrant or any evidence."
"That doesn't bother you?"
"It doesn't bother you that a grown man can rape a 13-year-old girl and get away with it?" Kate didn't know what to say. This wasn't a philosophical question around the dinner table. There was a real man out there who had raped a real little girl. Maggie said, "Get used to putting your notebook in your back pocket. The spiral will burn a hot spot on your chest in the summer." Kate didn't point out that Maggie kept her notebook in her breast pocket. Instead, she tried to lighten things up.
"You think I'm still gonna be around by summer?"
Maggie didn't answer.
"Dabblers, that's from the matchbook, right?"
Again, she didn't answer. Kate figured she might as well get all of her questions out of the way.
"How do you know those two women?"
"Night school."
"College?"
Kate heard the surprise in her voice.
"I mean..."
"We all answered that ad in the back of the comic book where you draw the turtle."
"That's not what I meant."
Again, Maggie didn't respond. They'd reached another set of steps. Marble, grander than the back set. Maggie took them two at a time. Kate gripped the railing as she followed. She couldn't spend another day acting the part of an ill-trained puppy. She told Maggie,
"Stop, please."
Maggie waited at the bottom of the stairs. She looked at her watch.
"Have I done something wrong?"
Kate knew how stupid the question sounded.
I mean, obviously I'm doing everything wrong, but is there something specific I've done to make you mad at me?
Maggie remained silent.
Is it because of the sheep sobriquet?
Kate realized that she might not be the only one humiliated by the episode.
I'm sorry, I should have just let my equipment hit me. I'll know better next time.
Sobriquet. Maggie looked down at Kate's feet. What size shoe do you wear?
8.
Kate lied before she remembered this wasn't Saks.
I mean, 9.5.
You can borrow a pair of Jimmy's old shoes. They'll fit better than what you have. She nodded toward the door. The gesture was turning into a tick. We'll go by my house. You can't come in.
Your house?
My house, where my brother and I live. She talked to Kate like she was a child. We'll go by my house to get some shoes that actually fit your feet. And then we'll go to the diner on Moreland Avenue. We're supposed to meet Jimmy there in 30 minutes. We're going to work on some files with him until around lunchtime. And then we'll go to CT with Gail in case I need backup, and you're still trying to figure out how to tie your shoes.
Kate didn't know which question to ask first. Files?
Kate watched Maggie's back as she walked through the empty lobby toward the glass doors. There were two options here. She could follow Maggie, or she could jump on her back and beat her with her fists.
Kate let herself enjoy the fantasy behind curtain number 2 for just a few moments. It was such a wonderful fantasy. But despite what Philip thought about her purpose in life, Kate knew she wanted children one day. Yet again, she followed Maggie out the door.